So good morning again, and a hearty welcome to all of you to the 60th, and yes, I said the 60th annual joint meeting of the Cornell University Board of Trustees and University Council. The direction in which education starts a person, Plato tells us, will determine his future. And he was right, especially if that education included 4 years or more at Cornell University. In its beauty, abounding energy, and intellectual force, Cornell had such a formative and fundamental influence on all of our lives. To return to the place is to return in a meaningful way to our roots. Today's gathering includes the most dedicated, talented, and loyal Cornellians, 57 trustees and trustees emeriti, 24 presidential counselors, and 720 council members and their families, faculty, staff, and students. The weekend, I trust, will provide you opportunities to rekindle friendships, discover something new, and share your thoughts about Cornell. When you leave on Saturday or Sunday, and many of you, I suspect, will be reluctant to leave, I hope you'll share my conviction that David Skorton and his colleagues on the faculty, administration, and staff are focused, flexible, and fiercely committed in these challenging times to keep Cornell in the forefront of the great universities of the world. Yeah. Let's take a moment to remind ourselves and congratulate ourselves on the extraordinarily distinguished collective we assembled in this room. Selection to the council constitutes recognition of exemplary service to Cornell, and service that we do not take for granted, not these days or ever. The council renews itself by electing 1/4 of its membership each year. Today, we greet 70 new members coming from as far as Australia, Hong Kong, Korea, and the United Kingdom. The Board of Trustees also welcomes new members. A student-elected trustee, Derek Evanson, is an MS PhD student in natural resources. He served as president of the Graduate and Professional Student Assembly and on the Provost Strategic Planning Advisory Committee, and somehow Derek finds time to be on the Cornell sailing team. The Frank H.T. Rhodes Professor of Environmental Science in the College of Arts and Sciences and chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, Nelson Hairston is a faculty elected trustee. He has served on many university committees, including the search committee for the new dean of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Robert Langer graduated from the College of Engineering in 1970. Currently, the David H. Koch Institute professor at MIT, Bob is a distinguished researcher in biotechnology, especially in the fields of drug delivery systems and tissue engineering. He is a member of the Biomedical Engineering Advisory Council here at Cornell. Linda McCauley, a 40-year member of the Lab of Ornithology, currently serves on the lab's administrative board and heads its chairman's council. An expert and prolific birdsong recordist, Linda has assembled one of the most important collections at the lab's McCauley Library. Leland Pillsbury, class of 1969, co-founded Thayer Lodging Group. Lee is a member of the Hotel School's Dean's Advisory Board, the Real Estate Council, the Trustee Investment Committee, and board member of Cornell Rowing. He was recently named a Frank H.T. Rhodes Class of 1956 visiting scholar. A graduate of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and Weill Cornell Medical College, Gene Resnick is an alumni elected trustee. He is the president of Oncology Business United and executive vice president of another leading international clinical contract research organization. He served on the Cornell Life Sciences Advisory Board, the CALS Dean's Advisory Council, and is immediate past president of the Weill Cornell Alumni Association. A graduate of the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, Dahlia Stiller is an architectural consultant for a very successful Florida real estate investment firm that specializes in the creation of open-air shopping centers. She has served as a member of the Architecture, Art, and Planning Advisory Council. Finally, Cheryl Tucker is an alumni-elected trustee, a 1978 graduate of the College of Arts and Sciences. Cheryl is a media and conference development consultant to Time Warner. She is a member of the Cornell Magazine Board of Directors, the Cornell Alumni Mentor Program, the Cornell Black Alumni Association, and was vice chair of the President's Council of Cornell Women. I ask this great new class of trustees to stand as we welcome them to the board. Permit me now to recognize Chairman Emeritus of our board, Harold Tanner, who is accompanied here this morning by Nikki Tanner. Harold, thanks as always for your enthusiasm, experience, engagement, and expertise. Harold Tanner. I'd also like to recognize Robin Davison, wife of David Scorton, accomplished scientist, mentor to many graduate students, and a truly wonderful Cornell ambassador. Robin, thank you. I want to thank Nancy Meinig. I want to thank Nancy for the straight from the shoulder advice that she gives to the chairman of the board, sometimes even when it's not solicited, but also by graciously participating in and also hosting many, many Cornell events around the country. Nancy, thank you. Yeah. And finally, let's recognize Cornell's former presidents who link our past to our future. Dale Corson, Cornell's eighth president, is recovering from a fall, but is certainly here with us in spirit. And today, Frank Rhodes, Cornell's ninth president, becomes 84. That's a venerable age for a veritable sage. Frank, we count our blessings for the many decades that you have graced us with your presence at this great institution. Thank you. It's now my pleasure to introduce Mitch Lee, class of 1990, and law school graduate, class of 1996. Nick chairs our council and has done a wonderful job. Mitch, we look forward to your remarks.
Call me Nick if you want, Pete. Hey, it's fine. But thank you, Pete, for the introduction and for your unwavering leadership here at Cornell University. 5 years ago, nearly to the day, Jay Wax, the chair of the University Council, stood at this podium and addressed the issue of diversity within Council, stating, "If we are to be effective ambassadors, if we wish to serve Cornell's face before students, young alumni, funding sources, and our leaders in the government, the membership of this council must be closely reflect our student body." Jay went on to say, "Diversity makes for a rich tapestry. We must understand the threads of the tapestry are equal in value, no matter how they are colored. These may be thoughts of a 20th century American poet, Maya Angelou, but they simply echo the guiding 19th century principle of Ezra Cornell: any person, any study, a principle upon which this great university's benchmark of diversity was founded." Jay went on to challenge the University Council, stating, "So here's your charge. Each of you must nominate the very best of our alumni with a keen eye on racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and geographic diversity. In making these nominations, our council's next generation rests in your hands." Thanks to the vocal and consistent leadership with respect to diversity from Jay Wax, Charlie Flager's team and the Office of Alumni Affairs, University Council members, and the Board of Trustees, I stand before you as the first African-American chair of the Cornell University Council. And so it's quite fitting that it was Jay Wax who called and informed me that I was nominated to be chair of the University Council. I was immediately humbled and honored by the nomination, but voiced some concern about the heavy workload and responsibilities that involved being chair of the council. We were in the throes of the Great Recession, which made for a challenging work environment for me personally. My wife and I had two young children, 3 years old and 1 year old of age at the time, who required a great deal of attention. And then seeing how hard the previous chair, Ronnie Chernoff, worked for council made it seem like an even more daunting task. However, in Jay's typical persuasive fashion, Jay could sell you the Brooklyn Bridge if he wanted to. Jay assured me that the job would be a piece of cake. The University Council is a well-oiled machine. The staff of Alumni Affairs do a good amount of the heavy lifting. Marty Moses and Mary Sue Taub have been doing this stuff for years with their eyes closed. Thus, Jay ultimately convinced me that I could take on the extremely important and esteemed role of chair of the University Council. Fast forward a few weeks later to my first meeting as chair. Two members from the Board of Trustees, Diana Daniels and Lisa Skeet Tatum, informed me that the university was undertaking a review of its alumni volunteer programs. And the University Council was the first program to be reviewed. They needed my help. In addition, the Office of Alumni Affairs announced at the meeting that the university had offered volunteer retirement incentive packages to long-serving staff. Both Marty Moses and Mary Sue Taub intended to take the retirement packages. The very two people who were the oil to the University Council's well-oiled machine were retiring. I quickly saw my life flash before me and looked across the room at Jay Wax. Jay shrugged his shoulders, smiled, and said, "Sorry, kid, I didn't know." But what Jay did know was that as the new chair of the University Council, I had served as a vice chair and under both him and Ronnie Chernoff, the previous chairs of council. And thus, I experienced firsthand the quality of leadership and passion to Cornell that each exuded. Moreover, Jay knew that although key and talented people were retiring, I still was surrounded with numerous folks across the University Council and the Office of Alumni Affairs and within the ranks of the University Council itself. These folks, I quickly learned, were the best and brightest. The high level of engagement and interaction that I have among my fellow alumni and council and staff within the Office of Alumni Affairs and Development has made my chairmanship not only a piece of cake, but an outright joy and the most fulfilling volunteer experience I have ever had. Cornell's alumni and staff, Cornell's alumni and staff are truly as talented and as dedicated a group of folks that you will find anywhere. They are truly the best and brightest. So where are we now with the University Council? In July of 2009, my vice chairs, Ariel Balin, Rod Chu, Christina James, Jay Taylor, John Quinones, and Jay Silpley, together with Chris Marshall and the staff from Alumni Affairs, undertook a review of the University Council as requested by the Board of Trustees. As part of that review, we recognized that the Council maintained its legacy as a highly respected and meaningful Cornell organization with high quality and ever-growing diversity of membership. However, like many established organizations, the University Council faced several challenges. There was a lack of consistent clarity among our membership as to what the University Council was all about. Who are we? What are our responsibilities? Should there be clear metrics to judge the success of the organization? To help us with these questions, we put in place an advisory board comprised of the best and brightest Cornell alumni and staff. Glenn Altshuler, Diana Daniels, Susan Murphy, Carolyn Newman, Lisa Skeet Tatum, Pat Watson, Jay Wax, Laura Wilkinson. These folks represented my Cornell all-star lineup that could take on LeBron James, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade any day in my book. While Glenn Altshuler may have some problems at the point guard position, but I'm confident that Glenn would make up for any deficits with pure heart and on-the-court tenacity. Ultimately, the advisory board helped us understand the importance of respecting the long legacy and success of Council while we explored how to further enhance and improve the organization. As part of understanding how to further enhance and improve the organization, last fall, the advisory board concurred that we should conduct a survey of our members. From that survey, we concluded the following. In answering the question, who are we and what are our responsibilities, the survey results confirmed that the University Council members firmly understand that being a member of Council is one of the highest honors that can be bestowed upon a Cornell alumnus. It is a reward for exemplary service to the university within one's profession or community. We are premier ambassadors for Cornell. As ambassadors, our job is to be well-informed, learn about Cornell's strengths, programs, challenges, and successes by attending the Trustee Council annual meeting and taking this information back to our local communities as we continue to promote our great institution of academic learning. We should identify new interest areas where we can add value to the university. In addition, we should maintain, if not exceed, the level of engagement that supported our election to the Cornell University Council. In short, as is often said, our reward for exemplary service to Cornell is even more service to Cornell. In addition, based upon the survey results, we concluded that the University Council should be evaluated at least annually based upon six key metrics. And in no particular order of priority, the first metric is Trustee Council annual meeting. TCAM, as I said, is the Cornell University Council's signature annual event. Our membership survey, when asked what aspects of the University Council are most important and should not be changed, TCAM weekend was the most common and universal response. The overall survey feedback was highly favorable with any suggested changes to the event primarily on the margins. New member orientation is a second metric as to how the University Council should be evaluated. Most members are formally exposed to University Council at our annual new member orientation luncheon. In our 2009 membership survey in connection with new member orientation, some commented it seemed like more of an orientation to procedures than an explanation of purpose and mission, and the new members wanted more of a roadmap for how to become a contributing member. Thus, we're now putting more time and attention into new member orientation, but we still have work to do here. Currently, we're exploring allowing the most recent University Council class to drive the orientation program for incoming members. A third metric as to how to judge the University Council's performance concerns communications. Historically, the primary vehicles of the University Council communications involved our website and email updates to members solely concerning Trustee Council annual meeting. In our membership survey, many recommended a periodic University Council newsletter. They stated the newsletter should be electronic and provide University Council-specific information. Thus, at the request of our members, this year we launched our first electronic newsletter with University Council-specific information, which includes updates concerning committees and information on our members. The newsletter has been a great success and can be found on the University Council website. The fourth metric, committees. A consistent theme from last year's survey was that the members wanted University Council engagement to occur more than merely once a year at the Trustee Council annual meeting. Moreover, given the size of the University Council, many stated they liked the intimacy of working on a committee. It was on the committees where they really got to know their fellow University Council members on a one-to-one basis. In addition, our members requested an opportunity to take on more meaningful tasks at the committee level, more transparency concerning the selection of the chair to the committee, to the two committees, and more two-way communication between the university rep and committee members. Thus, the tribe has spoken, and we have recently restructured our committees to meet these demands of our members. A fifth metric is giving and development. As many of you know, the council was created following the success of the 1950 Greater Cornell campaign. Francis Sheets, the vice chair of the campaign, told trustees he believed the campaign's success was a result of its knowledgeable and dedicated alumni advisors. Thus, a permanent group of such advisors was established to advance fundraising and development work for the university, the Cornell University Council. The council's roots are in development and giving. And as part of our survey, our members universally agreed that we should continue to strongly encourage every council member to make an annual gift to Cornell in an amount appropriate to that individual's circumstances, so that the council will each year reach the goal of 100% participation. This past fiscal year, we had a participation rate of 77% among our members. As part of benchmarking our performance, we want to demonstrate annual improvement in our development and giving. Thus, I ask for your commitment with me to reach the goal of 100% participation this fiscal year. And finally, the sixth metric as to how to judge the University Council's performance involves diversity. One of the outcomes of last year's survey was that it crystallized the continuing need to align council demographics with that of our ever-growing and diverse alumni base. We have made material improvements on this front, but we still have work to do. Today, 15% of all council members are persons of color, and women comprise 38% of our membership. However, approximately 31% of undergraduates are students of color, and women comprise 50% of the undergraduate campus. Thus, we cannot take our foot off of the accelerator when it comes to diversity on council. 1 year of failing to nominate a diverse class of university council members can materially set us back as an organization on the diversity front. So I challenge you all to nominate to council the very best and brightest of our alumni with a keen eye on gender, racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and geographic diversity. And in conclusion, I would like to thank Charlie Flager and members of the Office of Alumni Affairs and Development, and particularly Rob Delafuente, for all their hard work putting together the Trustee Council annual meeting of the highest quality. In addition, I would like to give a thank you posthumously to Joseph P. King. Mr. King was a Cornell alumnus from my hometown of Rochester, New York, who introduced me to Cornell University. Mr. King set the platinum standard for giving of one's time, talent, and treasures to Cornell. So thank you, Mr. King, for introducing me to this special place, which is Cornell. It is an honor and a privilege to serve as the 30th chair of the Cornell University Council, a council comprised of the best and brightest alumni, and Cornell's long-serving premier ambassadors. Thank you. Go Big Red.
Mitch, thank you for your comments. Thank you for your report, and thank you for your truly wonderful leadership of the council. It's now my pleasure to introduce David Skorton, President David Skorton. David's a gifted scholar, as you know, talented musician, candid, compassionate, and decisive leader, and a national and international spokesperson for higher education. As you may know, David, during the past month, received the highest honor in his field, appointment to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies. At Cornell, he holds appointments as a professor in three academic departments: medicine and pediatrics at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City, and biomedical engineering here in Ithaca. In keeping with Cornell's new strategic plan and his own vision of the his own vision for the university, David has made it Cornell's number one priority to enhance and rebuild our faculty, broadly but strategically, in anticipation of the wave of faculty retirements that are going to occur here at Cornell over the next decade. So I ask you to please join me in listening to the 12th president of Cornell University, David J. Skorton.
Be with you in a minute. As soon as I get this speech out, it's very long and heavy. So, well, good morning. I too want to welcome you as Cornell's leaders and my partners to the 2010 joint meeting of the Cornell University Board of Trustees and the Cornell University Council. I'm grateful, Mitch, for the leadership that you are exerting. We had a very good example of that during your remarks. Mitch, thank you so much for what you're doing. Nancy, I also want to thank you for your support and encouragement and for all that you do to help Cornell and, I suppose, Pete. Nancy Meinig, thank you. And I must tell you, I continue to be grateful in my fifth year working for the best boss I've ever worked for, Pete Meinig. I also want to echo Pete's reminder for us to always be grateful for the continuing wisdom and leadership that we have from the most recent previous presidents of Cornell University. And in the challenging times that we've had at Cornell and around the world the last couple of years, I've gained enormously from the advice of Dale Corson, and I join Pete and all of us in wishing our best for a speedy recovery for Dale, and Hunter Rawlings and Jeff Lehman. But let's talk about Frank Rhodes just for a moment, if we could. Just before coming up on stage, I asked Frank, I said, Frank, did you used to get butterflies in a day like this when you gave the State of the U? And he said, you know, it's so long ago, I don't really remember. And then I said, Frank, do you have any butterflies today? And he looked at me quizzically, and I said, would you have butterflies if I told you that I knew it was your birthday? And the smile melted off his face. Now, Frank, do you think that little business with Pete Meinig saying you were 84, do you think that's the end of it? No. Pete, will you help me get this crowd to sing Happy Birthday for Frank Rhodes?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Frank, you can now relax. And finally, before launching into the remainder of this very long and dry speech, I too want to thank Robin Davison for all that you do for all of us, Robin. Well, I can tell you this morning that Cornell University is on a new trajectory as we approach our sesquicentennial in 2015. Our mission and values and overarching goals, of course, have not changed and will not change. But we approach the milestone of 150 years with a sharper focus, a higher but achievable aspiration, and the resolve to move forward as one Cornell. The evidence of the success of our collective work involving Cornell's on-campus communities, trustees, overseers, council members, alumni, parents, and friends lies in plain sight. We are implementing changes in the administrative organization of this university that will save us over $75 million a year annually by the sesquicentennial, and we are on the track toward a sustainable budget that will include growth for this university. And just as important, we have and are reexamining many aspects of the university, not just to balance the budget, but to become a better university, the university that we would like to be. Three recent polls, national and international in scope, summarize for me the character of our Cornell. First, the World University Rankings by London's Times Higher Education capture the rarefied intellectual atmosphere of Cornell by placing us as number 14 among all the world's great universities, up from 15 last year. U.S. News and World Report ranked Cornell 7th, along with Dartmouth and the University of Chicago, in economic diversity among schools of our caliber based on the percentage of our students in the undergraduate population who qualify for federal Pell Grants for the lowest income families. In 2009-10, we had the highest number of Pell Grant recipients at Cornell in at least 5 years, and although we had this same percentage in some earlier years, the actual number of Pell Grant recipients was up over 100 last year. And third, Cornell was the only Ivy League university to earn a place on the Wall Street Journal's top 25 list of universities where corporate recruiters turn for talent, coming in at number 14 overall and number 7 in engineering. Intellectual power, access to students of talent and promise, regardless of background or economic circumstances, and skills sought after in the marketplace, even in a recession, that is our Cornell. Our future and our ability to excel will be based on the people of Cornell and how we treat them. First, our exceptional students, who make us proud by their accomplishments in the classroom, the laboratory, the studio, on the athletic field, and in their public service. Of course, they are the reason we are here and why Cornell is such a vibrant place. We believe it is imperative, and I believe it is imperative, for America's top universities to educate the next generation, regardless of background, regardless of financial means, in order for this nation to stay competitive in the global marketplace, and most importantly, to contribute to the solution of the world's problems. Even in the depths of the Great Recession, Cornell maintained our need-blind admissions policy and greatly strengthened our commitment to need-based financial aid. The latest development, beginning with the 2011-2012 school year for new students, that is next year, we will match the parental contribution level and need-based loan level of other Ivy schools to which our applicants are accepted, and we will also strive to match the need-based parental contribution and need-based loan level for Cornell applicants who are also accepted at Stanford, Duke, or MIT. Philanthropy is critical to our ability to provide and never waver on need-based financial aid. I'm very pleased to thank you and to report that Cornell alumni, parents, and friends have already contributed over $191 million for scholarships through the current Far Above campaign, and we continue to make progress toward our goal of $350 million in scholarships through matching gifts. Thank you very, very much. Second, the Cornell staff, the people who keep Cornell moving forward and make it possible for faculty and students to do their jobs. Although they have borne the brunt of personnel actions to decrease budgets in many parts of the university, members of our staff have continued to serve this university with dedication and with excellence. As we approach our sesquicentennial, we need to continue to value and to learn from our staff colleagues, to attract and retain a diverse workforce, to continue to provide opportunities within the staff for job skill training, and to collaborate with those in our local community to keep Ithaca in Tompkins County and New York City desirable places to live and to work. The third group critical to Cornell is our alumni. Thanks to the leadership of our trustees and overseers and members of this council and many other alumni and parents and friends, Cornell has just completed an astonishingly strong year in fundraising. With new gifts and commitments for the year that ended last June 30, up 77% over the recession-driven declines of the previous year, we reached a total of $466 million in 1 year. Last year, in fact, Cornell, in new gifts and commitments, topped all other schools in the Ivy League. Thank you. The Cornell Annual Fund recorded its 8th consecutive year of growth. Yes, that's right. Each year during the recession, you gave more money and your colleagues gave more money to this critical annual fund. It was up 12%, with over $27 million given by more than 32,000 donors. And I want to thank all of you, and I want to thank Trustee Bob Katz for his unerring leadership of the annual fund. I must say, Bob, you did better with the annual fund than you did with the Yankees. Anyway, why dwell on the past? So in terms of long-term commitments and current use dollars provided through philanthropy, thanks to you, we are doing extremely well, and we are very grateful. I want particularly this morning to remind us so that we can again celebrate a few truly transformational gifts from Cornell alumni and friends. Recently, a gift of $25 million from the Dyson family named the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management in CALS and has greatly strengthened Cornell's already very strong programs in this field. A gift of $10 million for the College of Veterinary Medicine from an anonymous trustee donor will establish the world's first canine genomics program, and it is the largest gift in the history of this top-rated college. Several very significant gifts have occurred for Cornell's Center for a Sustainable Future, including a gift of $5 million from Yossi Hollander to help address energy needs and help farmers in the developing world. And as you know, in the last 24 hours, a truly transformational gift of $80 million for the now David R. Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. David Atkinson and Pat, would you please let us honor you? With the talented leadership that Mitch mentioned in our Division of Alumni Affairs, we are finding new ways to reach alumni. The Cornell Alumni Leadership Conference, CALC, for example, the first ever in Washington, D.C. last January, brought together nearly 800 alumni volunteers for workshops and educational programming and fellowship. And Associate VP Chris Marshall and VP Tommy Bruce and I have conducted over a dozen webinars. A year ago, I didn't know what a webinar was. Hour-long interactive online conversations on a variety of topics, targeting alumni audiences around the world. We've had as many as 100 plus on the webinar at any one time. We've gotten tremendously positive feedback on those webinars. We have launched Cornell Connect, an online alumni directory, an event registration tool that handles over 1,400 events a year. And we're developing, of course, social media tools for alumni and affairs development, alumni affairs and development to use for a wide variety of purposes. A fourth and a most critical group essential to the core academic mission of Cornell, of course, is our faculty. And today I want to talk about faculty renewal because the time for faculty renewal is now. The strength of Cornell's faculty across the disciplines is reflected in our high standing in a comprehensive national study of research doctoral programs released just last month by the National Research Council. 61 of Cornell's 81 doctoral fields in the graduate school here in Ithaca and 7 doctoral fields at the Weill Cornell Graduate School of Medical Sciences were ranked in this study. No other private university in the United States had as many graduate fields ranked as Cornell. Almost half of this large number of fields, 29, were included within the top 10 range of rankings in an overall measure, and over 75%, or 47, were within the top 20 range in an overall measure. Our NRC top 10 ranges of rankings went across the board here in Ithaca and at Weill Cornell, and included 8 fields in engineering, physical and the mathematical sciences, 7 in agricultural sciences, 7 in the humanities, 6 in the biological and health sciences, and 3 in the social and behavioral sciences. Comprehensive, across-the-board excellence, thanks to the faculty of Cornell University. For the past decade, Cornell has generally been among the top 5 universities in the U.S. in funding from the National Science Foundation, and 2 years ago we were number 1 in the United States. We recently, for example, received $109 million in awards from the NSF to boost X-ray science and accelerator physics at Cornell. This funding will allow us to continue operation of the highly regarded Cornell High Energy Synchrotron Source, or CHESS, which is a national and international center for synchrotron X-ray research, and to continue development of the next generation X-ray source, the so-called Energy Recovery LINAC. Stay tuned, please. Currently, though, with all this good news, we have the oldest faculty in Cornell's 145-year history. Today, 47% of Cornell's professors are over 55. You know, it doesn't seem that old, really, but anyway, I'll just get back to the script here. 47% of Cornell professors are over 55, compared to 25% in the early 1980s, and many of us will retire in the next 15 years. During the recession, we suspended or canceled many faculty searches, and our hiring dropped to 43 in 2009-10, the second lowest number of faculty hires in a year in the last 30 years. In the coming decade, the provosts will need to hire upwards of 800, perhaps as many as 1,000 new faculty to enhance the faculty and replace those retiring. Now is the time to build the faculty of the future, and with it, the future of Cornell University. What will tomorrow's faculty be about? I suggest we must show the way in reinstating the value of knowledge as a priority in our society and the urgency of its pursuit, come what may. We must not retreat from the high intellectualism that has earned Cornell a place among the world's great universities, sharing broad and deep knowledge and nurturing the skills to interpret and critique and extend it. These are still the best ways to teach people who will live their lives amidst wildly changing conditions. As a physician and a biomedical researcher, of course, I firmly believe in the power of the scientific method to advance knowledge, but make no mistake, the world's most significant problems will not be solved by science alone. We need, of course, scientific and technical knowledge, as well as knowledge based on research in the social sciences and humanities, but we also need people and approaches to motivate others to act upon that knowledge, recognizing its power as well as its limitations and the ethical and moral issues it might raise. For that reason, we need to renew the faculty in each of the basic academic groupings, humanities and the arts, life sciences and agricultural sciences, physical sciences and engineering, social sciences, and the professional schools. We also need, of course, to be strategic in our hiring, as Chairman Meinig mentioned, targeting appointments within those broad areas of knowledge to fields where it's important for us to maintain or even increase our strength. Now, today, in addition to underscoring the need for a broad sweep of faculty hiring across this university, I want to make a special case for our efforts to bolster, in this university and across this country, the academic arts and humanities. Many changes are underway on this campus and in New York City, and these changes will substantially change the landscape of Cornell University. It is good and it is important to make these changes. At the same time, the provost and I want to make sure that we maintain strength throughout the university in the arts and the humanities. The need for investment in these areas is less intuitively obvious to many people than, say, investments to find cures for diseases, or alternative sources of energy, or to alleviate poverty or malnutrition. In fact, some have argued, as did an English professor at another university in a recent Chronicle of Higher Education column, that curricula change over time and the humanities simply do not have a place in the emergent university curriculum of the 21st century. Nothing could be further from the truth. Coursework in the humanistic disciplines is often promoted legitimately as a way to teach basic skills of critical and contextual thinking, communication, and ethics to scientists, engineers, business people, and those in other so-called applied professions. As they provide a foundation for success in a wide variety of careers, they serve as well as a prerequisite for responsible citizenship. As David Feldschuh, our professor of theater, film, and dance, has written, the ability to examine stories critically is a vital tool for any population that is to remain free and democratic. It is in the nation's interest and essential, in fact, to our global competitiveness to have the up-and-coming generations from all backgrounds educated broadly and educated well. But we must also recognize and support the value of the humanities as a discipline of research and critical analysis in its own right, and it's on its own terms. The events and creations of the past, of course, cannot change, but our knowledge of them can be enhanced through continued rigorous study and research. As Laura Brown, Cornell's Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, and John Wendell Anderson, Professor of English, and several of her colleagues noted in a recent essay, 21st Century Humanities at the Core of the University, concerns about life, wisdom, survival, transformation, and interaction have long been deeply embedded in the humanities. Although the methods of interrogation change from generation to generation, questions about the mysteries of life, the human trajectory, the relations between humans and nature, the quest for understanding of the universe and the world we inhabit are ongoing. The impact of the humanities as a critical endeavor is most visible and most familiar in the study of literature and the arts. But history, philosophy, law, linguistics, religion, and other humanistic disciplines can also help us grasp where we come from and why, in order to lead us into the future. One thinks of M.H. Abrams' The Mirror and the Lamp, Romantic Theory and the Critical Tradition, or Max Black's The Importance of Language, or Milton Convitz's Fundamental Liberties of a Free People, Religion, Speech, Press, Assembly, or Daryl Bem's work on personality theory, sexual orientation, and beliefs and attitudes, or Jonathan Culler's On Deconstruction, or Walter Lefebvre's The Clash, U.S.-Japanese Relations Throughout History, or Michael Kamen's People of Paradox, or Hunter Rawlings' The Structure of Thucydides' History. In addition, at a very fundamental level, the arts and the humanities teaches us what it means to be human. As I argued, for example, a few years ago during a Dana Foundation conference on transforming arts teaching, the role of higher education, music teaches in a way that we cannot replicate with words. Pedagogically complex, music transforms us, touches us alone or in a shared experience. And other creative activities, including art and literature, can be similarly powerful in their effects. Few of us have read Toni Morrison's Beloved, or Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, or Pearl Buck's The Good Earth, or Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, or works by younger Cornell-trained writers like Melissa Banks, Stuart Onan, Juno Diaz, or watched a play written by Jenny Schwartz, Class of 95 winner of the 2010 Drama Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Few of us have read or experienced these pieces without feeling enlightened, enriched, or even transformed. Despite all they bring to the human experience, to your experience and mine, The arts and humanities struggle for funding because their value is difficult to quantify, and they are not seen as contributing directly to economic growth or health or national security. Neither Democrats nor Republicans, in my view, have done enough to rectify this through appropriate financial support for the National Endowment for the Humanities or the National Endowment for the Arts. Indeed, thank you. Indeed, these two important cultural agencies have been tempting targets for those seeking to advance particular political or social or religious agendas or to show fiscal constraint. What are the data? In the 2010 fiscal year, appropriations for both the NEH and NEA remained in inflation-adjusted dollars down a full third from where they were in 1994. And by comparison, federal funding for the National Institutes of Health has nearly doubled in inflation-adjusted dollars in those years, and federal funding for the National Science Foundation more than doubled. Federal research budgets will make it easier for new faculty members in the sciences and engineering to find the support they need to drive innovation through their research, but the arts and humanities nationally need our help. As Kent Kleinman, the Gail and Ira Drucker Dean of Architecture, Art, and Planning, has noted, art and design are increasingly recognized as principal modes of addressing some of the world's most complex problems, including global climate change, rapid urbanization, and the impact of complex problems and technology on our social patterns. These issues, as Dean Kleinman noted, do not have linear solutions, but require iterative and expansive approaches that question the very nature of the problem itself. Of course, another very significant contributor to the vitality of the arts and the humanities at Cornell is our gem, the Johnson Museum of Art, which has been so ably led by Frank Robinson, the Richard J. Schwartz director, since 1992. Frank has raised the profile of the museum, spearheaded the museum's expansion that is now underway, and gained the respect and the affection of our community and the wider alumni body. Alas, Frank will be stepping down as the Johnson Museum's director next year, and of course will be mounting a national search for a successor. Frank, I hope you're with us this morning and that you'll stand and allow us to recognize you and express our gratitude. Over the next decade, the College of Arts and Sciences expects to hire more than 100 humanists. While most will be junior appointments, the college is aiming strategically to hire faculty at various career points in order to create an invigorating blend of perspectives and experiences, and in the future, a more regular rate of retirement and renewal. Thanks to a $2.5 million challenge grant we received a few years ago from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, and thanks to additional funding commitments that the College of Arts and Sciences now has in hand, we anticipate hiring 3 mid-career humanists as Mellon chairs, perhaps as soon as the end of this very semester. Now is the time for Cornell to step up and advocate nationally for the arts and humanities, as even locally we recruit faculty that will define this university for a generation. We need to hire the stars for future generations of Cornellians and give them the freedom, the intellectual and physical space, support, and infrastructure they need to allow their thinking free rein. Faculty hiring across the disciplines is a top priority, but join me in advocating where you live and where I live for attention to the arts and humanities. Faculty renewal in the context of academic priorities and substantial retirements is the number one priority in Cornell's new strategic plan. We need to demonstrate our commitment to faculty renewal across the university, taking advantage right now of an unusual, perhaps unique opportunity, and to get out in front of other universities for faculty hiring while we are in a position, thanks to you, to do so. To strengthen and support our efforts to build the faculty of Cornell's future. As many of you know, we have established a few months ago a $100 million faculty renewal fund to be funded equally through philanthropy and the reallocation of university resources over the next 5 years. David Kroll, class of 70, chair of the Finance Committee of the Board of Trustees, and his wife, Victoria, have stepped up and made a $5 million gift to the Faculty Renewal Fund, getting the effort off to a fantastic start. David, please stand so we can recognize you. Building the faculty of the future as part of the strategic view of Cornell's future is a once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-generation opportunity for Cornell. More than ever before in the history of this university, we have the opportunity, for all the reasons I mentioned, to become the university we want to be and we need to be. A university that after 150 years still combines liberal and practical education with a commitment to providing opportunity for students of talent and promise, no matter their economic circumstances. One of the few universities in the world to be recognized for its intellectual breadth and depth, the scope of its commitment to economic diversity in the student body, and the quality of its graduates as they enter the world of work. A university that can indeed meet its 21st century aspiration, and I quote from the strategic plan, to be recognized as a top 10 research university in the world and a model university for the interweaving of liberal education and fundamental knowledge with practical education and impact on societal and world problems. As we go forward together, I'm counting on your partnership. Thank you. Is it on now? Too bad for you. Okay, we have about, Charlie, what did Pete, 15, 13 minutes, something like that. Plenty of time for Q&A, plenty of time for me to escape from the hard questions. So anything you'd like to speak about, we do have microphones in the aisles and microphones, and this year I'll try not to be silly and forget about those sitting up there. Please.
David, we all know that Cornell is an institution where related studies are scattered around the university, related fields in different colleges. Can you give us some high points of how Cornell is attempting to rationalize the structure of the university, perhaps by grouping similar studies in more central places?
Yes, and I want to talk to you about the courage and vision that our provost, Kent Fox, and his colleagues, that is the deans of the colleges at Cornell and others, are taking and attacking this very, very important problem. Just to remind everyone, we've done three sorts of planning and, as we say, reimagining this great university in the last 20 months or so. One is to reduce as much as possible the cost of administering the university. And I mentioned the number that we're aiming for. We're very, very much on the way to that number. And we have, I think, done a very good job. We brought in outside advice, and no less another president besides me, Barack Obama, in August of this last year at a lecture at University of Texas Austin. We were the only private university he cited to say that we were doing our best to cinch down the cost of earning the university toward making it more affordable for students. So we're doing that one thing. Secondly, about a year and a half ago or so, the provost assigned task forces, 19 task forces, and one on the budget model of the university to look over not only what the future might look like in the colleges, assuming an environment of reduced revenue for a while, but also what you're talking about, cross-cutting thinking in some areas, social sciences and others, And then thirdly, we've developed a strategic plan. Between those three ways of thinking, how can you do things, perhaps save a bit of money, how can you rationalize things in a better way, and how can we actually make things better by combining forces, the provost is and the deans are very courageously tackling a lot of these problems. I'm not prepared today to tell you about the things that are yet to be introduced, but I can tell you that conversations are going on about the way we teach business and management, about the way we teach economics, and I'm not saying that we're going to combine all those things into a single entity, but the provost and the deans are working courageously and genuinely in trying to do exactly what you are talking about. If you watch the provost's love notes, Valentine's, that he gets frequently in the Daily Sun, you'll see that everyone's not satisfied with what's going on in the university. And I don't say that to be facetious, because it's a very, very, very unsettling time. Unsettling for the job shrinkage in the staff ranks, unsettling in the very much reduced rate of faculty hiring, unsettling in the still high cost of education at schools like Cornell, and unsettling in the fact that we are changing things that have been that way for a long time. So this may not be much of a reference because higher education tends to change slowly, but in my 31 years in higher education, nearly 20 of them in some sort of an administrative position, I've never seen anything like this before where people are with a will trying to face these problems. We're not going to get them all done at the same time, but we're tackling them, and just stay tuned is all I can tell you. Question up there in what we used to call the peanut gallery in my day? No? Other questions? Please. Take your time. The more time you eat up getting to that microphone, the less questions I have to deal with here. So go slow.
All right. I'm only doing this because nobody else stepped up. But first of all, Terry Ann Lowenthal, class of 1980.
Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciated your remarks about support for the arts and humanities as someone who spent most of my professional career in civic engagement activities in government. I think you're right on point, and I look forward to being involved in that. Speaking of government and civic engagement, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to make a little pitch because I have a captive audience, but related to what you said about NEA and the National Endowment for Humanities, one of our council colleagues who was on hiatus this year, but many of you know, Hanson Clark, is running for Congress, 13th District of Michigan, out of Detroit. He defeated the incumbent Democrat in August. It is what it is. He won handily, but you know, it's a tough thing to beat an incumbent. He's in an 80% Democratic district. So he is likely to be the next congressman from that district next Tuesday. So first of all, by the way, I hope you'll all support him. I'm helping him a little informally with his transition to Washington because he and I both worked in Congress together for a number of years, in addition to being Cornellians and Georgetown Law graduates. And then the other thing I just wanted to say to you is that he could be someone in Congress who could, you know, maybe take some interest. One of the things he said to me over the last 2 months, he keeps saying, Terry, I need to do more to help Cornell. And I keep saying, Hanson, focus on your election, and then you can do more for Cornell. But I know he's interested, and I hope you'll call on him.
Thank you. Now, I know that Vice President for Government and Community Relations, Steve Johnson, is sitting out there nervously wondering what I'm going to say in response to this. Am I going to endorse this candidate and get everybody all excited? Am I going to endorse the person on the other side of the ticket? Well, happily, because I'll be out of town next week, I already voted. And so I really can't do much personally to help this particular cause. But I will tell you that in order for Steve and I and the national community of those concerned about the arts and humanities to make a dent in this 16-year-old problem that's going in the wrong direction, we are going to need your help. Steve will be in contact with you through the Government Relations Committee of the Trustees and otherwise. We're going to do our best to launch a national campaign to try to increase funding for these two cultural agencies, and we're doing it lickety-split. We're going to be trying to do it in the next couple of months, so please stay tuned, and whatever you can do to help us get this message across would be greatly appreciated.
President Scanton, thanks for a very enlightening speech. I'm from Hong Kong. I'm a new member. I graduated '75. with the importance of international and Asia in particular, and I remember I saw you about 2 years ago in Hong Kong, can you share with us your vision for international expansion? Do you think Cornell is doing more than the top universities, at par or below? And can you give us what might be your strategy going forward?
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to see you again, and welcome. Welcome to the council, and welcome to this weekend. Cornell University, in its individual areas of excellence, is, by any measure one chooses to make, one of the most international and one of the most internationally engaged and one of the most internationally effective universities. Provost Tony Gatto is sitting here in the front row, and in the Weill Cornell College of Medicine, through its forward-looking areas of global health, a Cornell-trained physician named Jean Pape founded the first AIDS clinic in the developing world before, I believe, Tony, before we use the term AIDS, in 1979. And Weill Cornell works in many places in global health. On this campus, through the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and many other colleges and departments and programs, we've been doing things in international studies, that is, understanding the world, and in international activities for, in some areas, a century, and in many areas, a half a century. So without any sort of vision from above, the university has been doing fabulous. However, this is a time, as our colleague mentioned, for us to relook at everything we're doing to make it better. And I'm very pleased to tell you that Provost Fox has actually formally asked me to develop a white paper personally on internationalization for the university. I'm hugely honored that he asked me because I have great respect for his judgment and I have respect for the provost position. So I'm working on that. I'm speaking with people around campus and we'll be working that document up in weeks to come. And I'll be sharing it, of course, for advice as I like to do broadly, and then I'll be sharing it through the provost and through the provost for medical affairs broadly with the Cornell community. So I can just tell you two things I'm sure I'm going to say. One is that whatever vision comes from above should not get in the way of individual entrepreneurial thinking of faculty and staff and students in these many areas of excellence, which has really put Cornell on the map, literally and figuratively. And, however, secondly, that we could be doing better and that in some areas, we are at risk, especially with the faculty retirements, of going backwards. And so it's a perfect time for the provost to challenge me to do this, and I'm doing it with relish and enthusiasm. So you'll be hearing about it before too long. Yes, please. How are you?
Good. In the 1980s, the board held meetings in Washington, which were quite effective. And I remember one of the meetings, Frank Rhodes debated Bill Bennett right under the table. But the point I'm trying to make here is that what steps are being taken by the major top university presidents to frequently go to Washington because the name of the game is lobbying to get more money for education?
Now Steve Johnson is thinking to himself, Steve is thinking, now what's he going to say? Is he going to cast aspersions on the other 4,200 presidents toiling in the fields of American academia? Is he going to claim that only he has the vision to lead this group of... No, don't worry. Steve, relax. You and Frank both can relax now. Everything's going to be fine. So university presidents don't do enough in terms of using the bully pulpit to try to influence public policy. University presidents are timid in general. We're very, very worried about upsetting people who might invest in the university, people who might affect our futures in many ways. And we have to get beyond that. We have to find a balance between engagement on the one hand, where this is the time to step up and make statements, as we heard in our hugely talented panel in this room yesterday on sustainability. That point was made again and again. We have to balance that with the need for civility. My column in the Daily Sun this Monday, I hope you'll have a chance to read it, was on civility. And it's because we have fallen to, in my 61 years, a low ebb in this country in our public debate, in our public discourse, both in the quality of it, the content of it, but most importantly, in the incivil tone that is all over
whatever party you're in, whatever your political persuasion, we all ought to be ashamed of ourselves. So I think, as Steve will attest, I'm trying very hard to urge my fellow presidents in special meetings that we have in different groupings. And you can just imagine architecturally, when you put a bunch of university presidents together in a building, you have to reinforce because of the egos in the building. You can't just put them in the building willy-nilly. I mean, you've got to make sure that building can withstand those egos. But there are many, many strong presidents who follow really in Frank's footsteps. And I frequently quote Frank's, one of Frank's, what for me was a mind-opening book, Creation of the Future, that Frank has been using the bully pulpit both verbally and in writing for years, but yet we have to redouble our efforts now. My own theory is that alumni, whatever the political stripe or attitudes, will be more engaged with the university and, in fact, more generous the more they see the university as relevant in the world. So buckle your seatbelts. Steve Johnson and I are going to go out there and take a swing at it. Remember, Steve, however, I have tenure in three departments. So be careful what you say, pal. Please.
Last night, as I walked across the gorge, I was reminded of the tragedies that have happened here on campus in the last year. And the fences are a stark reminder of the issue. And I'm just wondering if you can comment about how, as a community, we can get in front of that or get ahead of it, or just any comments would be helpful.
Absolutely. Will you permit me, as I answer your question first, to ask the assembled multitudes to thank Vice President for Student and Academic Services, Susan Murphy, for what she's done. This is an unbelievably complicated, terrible national problem. Those of you who may have had a chance to see, I was interviewed by CBS Sunday Morning. It was on a few weeks ago, I forgot exactly when, to talk about this national issue. In my medical practice, which was in teenagers and young adults with chronic diseases, inborn heart disease, I got to learn plenty about the particular stresses at that age group. And in the 15 to 24-year-old age group, nationally, suicide is a very, very high cause of death in an age group where death is uncommon. The third cause of death after accidents and homicides. And on college campuses, it's the second highest cause of death after accidents. Homicides are much less frequent on college campuses because of gun control. So we have a huge national problem. And Susan Murphy and her colleagues have been national leaders, no matter what we experienced last year, make no mistake, have been national leaders in a public health, a broad approach to community health in mental health services for years and years and years. And prior to this tragic, horrendous, horrible year that we shared last year, Susan and her colleagues, Janet Corson-Riker, the director of the Gannett Health Services, and others, I believe more than doubled the number of mental health professionals in Gannett, just as one example. So Susan and Bill Fry, who is the dean of faculty, the elected leader of the faculty in Ithaca, and Kent Fox, the provost, I charged in April to look broadly at the experience that students have at Cornell relevant to these stresses. And they are looking at everything from the specifics of services delivered at Gannett to the academic calendar, to the advising system, and many other things that need to be looked at. This is a very serious problem, and it's a national problem. We're not going to have some memo from the head office, so to speak, that's going to turn this around. This is going to take all of us, parents and alumni and people on campus and the student across the hall and the student on the other side of the classroom to do three things. Number one, to be aware of each of us, how we feel in our hearts as we go through the stresses of this life, especially tough in a recession. Number two, to care about the person next to us. And thirdly, to accept help when we need it. So with those three rules that I think are never more critical than they are now, and with Susan and others' leadership, if anybody, any organization can get our arms around it, it'll be us. In terms of the specific thing you're asking about, the so-called means restriction on the bridges, We immediately put up, and you can blame me if you didn't like them, chain link fences in the summer to stop the cluster that we were experiencing. It did stop. And then we put up much less, I believe, less objectionable, but still temporary barriers that are up now on these bridges. And we have a group of very, very highly visionary people, including, as I mentioned him earlier, Dean Kleinman, the dean of our number one ranked undergraduate architecture in the whole college, and our facilities professionals and the staff, and outside architects and outside consultants working on how we will go forward to optimize the beauty of this fabulous community while being more protective of what we need to do. And someone's giving me one of these over here. I think we're going to take one more, boss. Is that right? One more. It's you.
Hi, Stephen Gall, class of 1988. After a career as an entrepreneur, I have had the great privilege last year to come back as a clinical faculty member, a practitioner faculty member in the Johnson School teaching entrepreneurship.
We're so grateful to you for doing that.
Thank you. I'm in the second year of a one-year tour, so really enjoying Ithaca. And one of the things that the real question I have is that in the business of academia, oftentimes a lot of practitioners or clinical faculty can hurt rankings or hurt schools to have too many people in those roles. By the same token, given the demographics, given the hiring challenges, et cetera, is there a view here as to how in this large faculty hiring group that more practitioners or more clinical faculty or more balance would be available, primarily to focus on the students, because there seems to be a great benefit there for students and for people like me, and there are quite a few of us, the peer group.
This is a really, really timely question, and I don't want to speak for the deans, because every dean is going to have his or her own vision, but I can tell you across the university and across the landscape of American higher ed, this mix, this dance between practitioners and others is going to be very, very important for the future. My background's all in professional education through medical schools, where I've lived in an environment where there was a wonderful cohabitation, I guess I could say, between the different types. And I think, Harry, for example, you're in a very area. Would you agree that we have to find a way to meld, to build a quilt of these different things? I can't give you any more intelligence because it'll be judged on a college-by-college and program-by-program basis, but it's one of the things that the deans are thinking about a lot. So grab Harry or others as you have a chance to. I want to thank everybody for paying attention and for being a part of this. Thank you.
David, thank you very much for your visionary remarks, and thank you for entering into a dialogue with the audience today. You say it the way it is, and people really appreciate that very candid interchange. I just want to make a very brief personal comment to the group assembled today. I have the advantage of really observing a lot of what goes on at this university. No one knows everything that goes on, but I'm probably as close as any outsider to what goes on. And I just want to say that I am so proud of the leadership that we have at Cornell, the leadership that David Skorton and Provost Kent Fox are providing to us, along with a great, great group of colleagues that support them. These people have worked over the last 2 years tirelessly to reduce academic expenses without diminishing what is the university's core mission of learning, teaching, and research. And at the same time that they have been doing that, they have initiated a strategic planning process which really will set the base for the university for many years to come. None of our peers have endeavored to initiate strategic planning. At the same time, all of our peers, together with us, have been looking for ways to reduce expenditures. And none of them, as a result, in my opinion, have accomplished as much as Cornell has accomplished. David and Kent and their colleagues deserve our gratitude and our support. So this concludes our meeting. I sense great electricity in the air, started yesterday with just the wonderful announcement of the David and Pat Atkins's gift, has continued with the many Cornell events, the great report from Mitch, the outstanding address by our president. I just hope that all of you will enjoy the rest of your time here on campus, and I look forward to working with you this coming year to make Cornell even more glorious to view. We are going to have a short break, and in 10 minutes at 10:20, we will, all of you that are interested, we will reconvene in this room for a report from our investment office, our chief investment officer, A.J. Edwards, and the chair of our investment committee, Paul Gould, and that will start in 10 minutes. So the meeting is over. Thank you very much for your attendance.